Hello from David Rutledge. Welcome to the Earshot podcast. And this is where we present documentaries, features, narratives, everything to satisfy your storytelling urge. Now, I have a question for you. What do you think of when someone mentions the Western Sydney suburb Macquarie Fields? Well, if you're not from the area and you read the papers or watch certain news programs on TV, then you could be forgiven for an image of riots and young blokes in hotted up Commodores, police chases, the whole struggle street stereotype. Well, of course, every place is much more than its media image would suggest. And today's guest, Lachlan Brown, an Australian poet of Chinese and Anglo-Australian heritage, helps us to remember just that. Lachlan discovered his talent for poetry as a student at Sydney University while regularly taking the long journey there from Macquarie Fields, and he developed a spare, observant style of writing that's very much informed by the place and by its relationship to the broader city. And today Lachlan is talking with producer Lee Redfern in Macquarie Fields.
Urban sprawl. Macquarie Fields, Springs Edge, 2004. Give me corrugated iron and grinning billboards and a day as brilliant as a fire escape. It's been raining for a week, but now the clear sky curves overhead like a fruiterer's expansive arm. The ducks understand, paddling in a creek flushed with prams and plastic and spectating blackberries that sprawl on banks. Train's delayed, but I'm feeling generous as a toddler laughs and snatches at the air. When I used to get bigger, I had one. It's the logic of the day, like exams ending or the local paper spilling ads onto the carriage seat. Outside, the cameos glide past, sunlight and breeze and green lawns winking. Businessmen talk of outsourcing, but the windows snare their gaze, along with a pretty girl wearing ripped jeans and a face like a pretty girl. If you die, then you can't go shopping. Not bad advice when the timetable stretches like chewy under the seat or a commuter's double yawn. There's that feeling on the edge of your skin as the train slides in smooth archaeology, gently brushing lines overhead. Looking out from under your sunnies, you could be a bass player, laying down an easy groove that squeezes around headphones and tracks footprints through carriage mines. Meanwhile, each station's concrete sparkle greets a morning flecked with toothpaste and cool breathing. And there should be a soundtrack to all this, perhaps the promise of empty pages and not just the train breaking with a sigh.
This is quite a scenic little car park. Can you describe what you can see for me?
Yep, so we're at the back of Glen Quarry Town Centre, and what triangulates this space is Glen Quarry Tavern, James Meehan High School, the shopping centre. At the back of Glen Quarry Tavern is McDonald's, which are all very significant spaces around here, I think.
So why would you say?
It's a guy just trying a whippersnipper out that he bought from Cash Converters behind us.
Which is just classic, and which is why we sometimes do our recordings in a studio.
Yeah.
So why are they significant places?
Each about community, I think, in interesting ways. Sort of communities of education and that temporary community you find at a pub at night. Or there's something strange and dangerous about that too, kind of the way the things that alcohol does to our community in Glen Quarry, and, yeah, the things that sort of the underfunding of education perhaps has done. And yeah, the shopping centre itself, of course, is a kind of symbol of capitalism and the interesting things about capitalism, that there is this freedom, but there also is a kind of distress at the same time. But I think car parks are interesting because anything could happen in them, and you just look around and you'll see a child crying, or you'll see someone starting up a whippersnipper that they've just bought from Cash Converters, or you'll see people with a trolley full of booze going to a wake. These moments that you might not think are poetic, that you might not think at the time are worth considering or worth putting into art, but I think they are. Because sometimes you think if no one else catches them, how are they going to be appreciated?
20 sestets. 1. This industrial area is like Wetherill Park Industrial Area, a nowhere or somewhere with wide streets and trucks reversing. The Subaru Centre blessing its rows of Imprezas, or the furniture wholesaler, where a flat, packed future will be the brittle souvenir of wasted days. Who says our dreams can stretch out like a roller door before it curls upwards and disappears into its automated self? 2, 3, 4. Here on the main street, two old men are smoking, and they release the ghosts of dragons with each breath. And it seems that the morning is recalling a colder conversation, casting itself back to those words that somehow push against the limits of ice and air. But now school kids arrive and drift toward the station, unfolding sleep from their limbs. 5, 6, 7. Evening in the car park, the sky slowly matching the colour of the asphalt, those empty spaces still marked by white lines or clusters of trolleys grazing the gravel surfaces. This world, where cockatoos riot in distant trees and then take off, filling the heavens like the stars we do not see.
'So I remember just at dusk walking through Ingleburn car park and the cockatoos rising and taking off and going into the evening sky. And I thought, that's a beautiful moment because they're white against the black car park. It was kind of a painterly moment, I guess, not that I'm a painter. Car parks have their own rhythms, their own phenomena, I guess. They're worth something. They tell us something, I think, if we're ready to listen, perhaps, or ready to see them. And this is our Red Rooster. I think it's interesting because it used to be a KFC and then it burnt down. And then a young guy at church made us pray for the KFC because he worked there every week. So he prayed for KFC every week. Now it's rebuilt as a Red Rooster, which is kind of cool. There's something in that story I think about my poetry because of that mixture of the sacred and the profane, perhaps. Or I know they're not the best words to use, but yeah, the spirituality of things that you might not think of as spiritual. And so we're here at BP and Caltex. So I was thinking about these service stations when I wrote a poem in 9 parts about service stations. Shall I read it?
Or? Come over here. We won't stand in the middle of the car park while we do that, just in case.
Petrol stations, or 9 vouchers without the optimism. And it starts with a quote from Borges's Partial Enchantments of the Quixote, which says, "It is as if a novelist of our day were to sketch a satirical caricature of, say, service stations, treating them in a ludicrous way." 1. No one knows the entrance or exit, so cars end up nose to nose, like awkward lovers. Double take, reverse, in gear, out of gear. Every time the light turns, another one swings into this confusion, where affection is measured by momentary politeness, the crunching of a car door. 2. This is the world walled by sheer glass, by counter and closed circuit cameras. I am thinking of the attendant's dreams. But it's not dreams exactly that offers a space inside where margins are higher. 8. On a cold morning, a car will lean into the day, dip back onto the main road, struggle toward each new set of lights. Freedom means roundabouts or tollways or a hubcap left on a roadside spinning like a coin. 9. Granted, the end must begin somewhere, with numbers edging upwards, with the apocalyptic click of the Bowser. And instead, a surveillance camera is staring down reality, the world cowering into grey submission beneath its single, determined eye.
Do you want to talk a bit about that poem? Is it rude to ask a poet to explain their poems?
I don't think it's rude to ask, but well, I think it's a great impulse. I mean, John Ashbery talks about poets trying to explain something in the world when they're writing a poem. So if you explain a poem, then you have to, and then you're talking about an explanation of an explanation. So you're always going to have problems. But I think people want to hear poets speak about their poems. So I don't think it's a terrible question. That poem, I guess, again, is about those small moments that make up the things that we do every day. And if you frame them differently, or if you think about them perhaps in a way that you might not have thought about them before, they can open up into beautiful things. I mean, Borges opened that up for me, and I thought, well, what would it be like if I were to think of petrol stations in that way? Those small gestures when you pull your car out, when the Bowser clicks over. What if they were a kind of code for something else, for something greater, part of a kind of bigger story or a tapestry of something that's, yeah, intense and difficult and beautiful in a strange way? Coming home. That bloke looks like someone I know, like a journal I should be writing. I'm lucky though, caught in that historical moment where bass solos actually sing. Maybe it's time to join the inner city crowd, but the skyline gets me, drags me back, gums spread out over James Meehan, radiant in the day's last gasp, like jewellery in a pawn shop window or literature before it's thrown through classroom doors. You've still got metronomes out here, along with an hour's train trip to smooth over abstract thinking. Now sleep's approaching, next to a world drawn through newspaper headlines. Outside, the kikuyu snares through silent garden beds, and all of Sydney's given up on causes. Time to settle for ulterior motives then. Theorists lining up late like Thursday night wheelie bins. And this chessboard suburb, where every lung expands and contracts with its own economy, each breath another loan repayment or a tax deduction blinking like a cursor.
Interested in you as a poet who listens to Debussy and plays music and has had cultural interests that aren't necessarily associated with places like Macquarie Fields.
Mm.
How you feel moving through this space? Do you always feel a part of the place, or what's your position in relation to it?
Yeah, good question, because I think I grew up here, but I don't think of myself as necessarily someone who is totally representative of the place. I mean, there's all sorts of contradictions. So I grew up in not a disadvantaged household in any way. You know, Mum made us learn piano, and we enjoyed learning piano and French horn and other instruments. We used to go out at the back of Macquarie Fields to Long Point, which is down a long road into the backs onto the river, the Georges River, and a lady out there would have little recitals for everyone who, all the kids who learn piano, so we'd go out into these spaces and play different songs. And I've got to play in orchestras, Sydney Youth Orchestra and Sydney Uni Orchestra. But I saw the disadvantage of the suburb in so many ways, which sort of kind of tugs at your heart and informs who you are. So my mother was a French and Latin teacher before she had us. She went to Sydney Girls. My dad was from the country and he was a mechanical engineer. So my parents met in Leeton and moved to Macquarie Fields. So my mother is Australian-born Chinese and my father is Anglo-Australian from generations of farmers near Forbes, Jerobong near Forbes. So, I grew up being made to do middle-class things, play the piano, study hard. But it was in this place, I guess, which is a different place to the places that some people grow up, but in many ways similar. I mean, we all have these similar experiences, perhaps, of oil and burgers, of service stations. So I guess there is a sense in which I'm aware that I can never represent this place, that I can't be the voice of this place, even though I'm speaking about it. And I hope my poems articulate that problematic stance, that problematic position, where you're a participant because you're from a place, but you're also a viewer. And poetry puts us in a strange position because, particularly my poems, they're so often about viewing places that you're also strangely involved with, but not involved with as well. So when you take up a position to write a poem, lots of times you stand back, and that's exacerbated, you know, when I'm writing poems about riots or disturbances. That's exacerbated by the fact that I'm not rioting, in a sense.
Police maintained the sedan they were chasing in Macquarie Fields just before 11 o'clock last night was travelling at high speeds before they started following it.
Macquarie Fields, Autumn's Edge, 2005. Creative as a cardboard Santa or a battle axe block, that's enterprise the Australian way. It's on the news though, jostling Oscar winners and royalty for the top spot. I'm beginning to rue the classified style and links that fold back on themselves. All around us, communities are losing the art of mowing. Tragique. And yet there are alternatives.
For the third night in a row, at least 100 teenagers have clashed with police in Macquarie Fields in Sydney's southwest.
Interior design at the local Chinese or green electrical boxes sprayed with tags and sets of dangling legs at dusk. Don't tell me you're not a fan of fireworks or fence palings spiralling into an officer's shield. Around the corner, someone lights a mattress and 2 million TVs flicker like post office gossip. Next, they're wheeling in the news vans, but kids on bikes crowd out reporters whilst the rest of us string together theories about bulldozers and ghettos and why our church has no chance of attracting a minister now.
Rioters set a car alight in a public housing area of the suburb and attacked a squad of 50 police officers with stones and Molotov cocktails, breaking one officer's hand.
Tomorrow it might be more like failed social experiment and scrounging for a tenner to blow at the TAB.
Four people have been arrested and charged. One of them was bitten by a police dog in the process. The violence follows the deaths of two local teenagers who were killed during a police car chase on Friday night.
But until then, helicopters circle and drone like half-hour headlines, or four Saturday morning victors trying to outdo one another. The reality is, at the end of the day, it's us and them, except for the good ones. Meanwhile, hooded kids throw rocks the size of large golf balls as members of the gated community putt to save par on the other side of the tracks. I'm somewhere in between, I think, like a fallacy, wrestling with the distant cheers that accompany each firework and watching the bricks sail silently off screen.
Tell me about the riot. Were you here?
Yeah, my wife and I were living in a little flat that we'd rented just after we got married Yeah, it was an interesting time because it was a time of disturbance, but also a strange sort of festival atmosphere here. The riot wasn't in our street, but we could hear it from where we were living. And so you'd watch the telly and then you'd go outside and hear the cheers. And yeah, kids from youth group were riding their bikes down there and seeing what was going on. So there was a strange sense of tension and violence and real pain, because community pain, but also of, you know, that moment when someone gets to go behind a reporter and wave their hands around and smile. It was that sense of joy that we're being noticed and appreciated and come on, let's get on TV. I mean, you know, when a television program decides to take notice of you, that's something important for our world. And so there was a kind of sense of joy there too. That being said, I mean, the circumstances leading up to the riot in many ways are very sad. The guys who died, and yeah, it was just a very, very sad situation. And the kind of social systems that lead a place to think that that's the kind of response. I mean, so riots are, they say something about our society and what's gone wrong. They're symptomatic, in a sense, of situations that don't have obvious solutions and situations that have been probably repressed. I mean, we see that in Paris 2005, in London 2011, in Greece as well. Yeah, the riots are indicative of things that have been deeply, deeply wrong for so long. And so here it was family breakdown and lack of responsibility, but also underprivilege and just, yeah, generations of problem and poverty, and even things like the way that housing commission houses are designed, with communal spaces that were meant to be great but ended up having issues. Yeah, so lots of things coming together, and yeah, that's why I think I'm interested in them. But no, I didn't pick up a rock and throw it, or attack a policeman, or yeah.
Did you get behind a reporter?
No, I didn't wave my arms and but perhaps, I mean, that's the ambivalence of the poems. Perhaps the poems are in a sense, a symbolised version of that, as well as being lots of other things, trying to work through this difficult amalgam of responsibility and power and underprivileged. Perhaps they are that kind of gesture, hand waving behind the camera. I like that.
We're at a not very churchy-looking church, to my eye.
This is Glencore Anglican Church, the church that I grew up in, and the church has a lot of fantastic memories, wonderful people. Outstretched arms for Noel Rowe. Maybe I'm getting used to it. The drive down the M5, black bitumen as smooth as any beach, the search for parking in Randwick, heels clicking in hospital corridors, and my brother's measured breath. Intensive care is quiet, like a library, where machines and nurses speak in lowered tones, as if death was sleeping nearby, not to be awakened. We're trying to talk to him, but it's hard to speak to stillness. The doctors keep saying, "You must remember his coma score was very low," though young people often surprise us. My youngest brother should be studying for the HSC, according to my parents. Instead, he carts his dreadlocks and skateboard past hospital security and tries to chat up the pretty British nurses. I don't know how to comfort him when he starts crying. So we don't talk much about the accident or the operations that aren't succeeding. Instead, we argue about the radio station in the car, or we tell stupid stories, trying to capture moments in nets of cynicism and hard-eyed laughter. Sometimes we offer each other alternatives. I'd rather fail the HSC. I'd rather fail uni than have a body prized from a snarl of metal lying silently beside me. Perhaps we're each remembering backyard games of cricket in fading suburban light. or the three of us on bikes, weaving through South Coast scrub on our way back to campfire and breakfast. After one operation, the shunts probe my brother's brain to measure the pressure. The doctors tell us that we each have an ICP of 3 or 6 when we've got a headache. Now visiting time is consumed by shifting numbers that seem to be always rising, like Sydney real estate or a bad economy. One day it goes up to 46 and I can hardly stand. Leaving his room, we go for a walk along the Coogee headland, wind-bending grass like a reefed handbrake, and throwing spray into our faces. What is the Holy Spirit? A boy with a plastic bucket and spade asks his father on their way back to the car. My ears strain for the answer, but the wind snatches it and sends it flying over the cliff face. The sea always reminds me of La Mer, an orchestra of salt and movement. I imagine myself at my parents' house playing Debussy again on the family piano, the maid with the flaxen hair. It's afternoon, and Mum's cooking dinner in the next room. Looking out the window, I can see my brother through the backyard's fading light, knocking nails out of fence palings, whilst overhead the jacaranda is blessing the lawn with its flowers, each falling gently like a final dying note.
That poem does seem a lot more personal.
Hmm.
So what made you decide to end this collection with that one?
Yeah, I think that's a different poem because of the intensity of that experience, in a sense. And it's, I think there are times in our lives when things get stripped back. And when tragedy or something strikes, then, I mean, where do you turn? And so I think I wanted to end the volume with this poem because it perhaps, I mean, it's got, it takes a family at its most vulnerable and an eye, a lyric eye, at its most vulnerable that's not perhaps evident in the other poems in the volume, because I still think there's something important about that, and that poetry can do things with a lyric eye, and poetry can express personal emotions, even though theory will say all sorts of things. But there are some times when you just think, I just want to speak, I just want my brother to speak, I just want to hear him, I just want to reach out and touch him, and if he spoke, I would understand. And so there's a longing there in this poem, and yeah, it's hard for me to talk about this poem in a lot of ways. I mean, it's such a difficult thing to speak about, but perhaps poetry gives us some words or a mode of speaking about this stuff.
Lachlan was speaking with Lee Redfern, who produced the program, with sound engineer Phil McKellar. And you heard works from Lachlan's collection Limited Cities, published by Girimondo. I'm David Rutledge. Thanks very much for your company. This has been another Earshot podcast. I'll catch you next time. Bye for now.